Radio. This is Stuart Acuff, your host, with his leader, the president, CEO, director of the board of directors of Enlightened Radio, John Case, being such a good friend that he's in here today, twisting the knobs, setting the sound, and keeping us on the air. It's so good to have you with us this morning. Lots of great news today, and a special treat today. I'm calling in a little bit later today will be Bill Fletcher, F-L-E-T-C-H-E-R. You might want to Google him. The leading public intellectual from the labor movement, a working class intellectual, author of several books, hundreds of blogs and poems, longtime friend of mine, and one of the smartest people. He and John Case are probably the two smartest people I've ever met.
Why aren't we making more money?
Yeah, because it ain't a priority. That's why we're not making more money. Oh, yeah, John knows. I just had my debit card canceled for about the sixth time in the last 6 months by Wells Fargo. I'm changing banks, man. I can't handle this. It's a great morning. Bill Fletcher, one of the leading public intellectuals of America, former director of TransAfrica, National Education Director of the Service Employees Union. He was one of the people that we all worked with as we changed that union into the organizing powerhouse that it's become. And he was also former education director of the National AFL-CIO. So we're going to ask him about our resistance and about its social movement aspects and where he thinks we ought to go, what he thinks we ought to do, and how does he rate Trump in a historical context? Where does Trump fall in an historical contest? So we're going to have a great show today, and I'm so glad to have you with us. So glad to be joined here in the studio by John Case, late of Shea Case, he's got a new house in Harper's Ferry. It's a beautiful, beautiful house.
It was owned by a gardener who has presented us, as spring evolves, with an orchestra of color.
Yes, 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 indeed. I'm witness to it. It certainly is an orchestra of color. It also has a real live train caboose mounted on rails in the backyard. It's quite a trip, this place of John Case's. But so much good news this morning. Now we've got several doctors wondering whether or not dementia or Alzheimer's has settled in on Donald Trump. Because Trump is forgetting everything. Monday, he was in the hometown of Paul Ryan. And during his speech, he called Paul Ryan Ron four times. Twice to two different kids. He took their hat and signed it and then sailed it into the crowd instead of giving it back to the kid. And he has forgotten who Kim Jong-il is. He conflates Kim Jong-il with his father, Kim Jong-soo. I think was his father's name. Isn't that right, John? Kim Jong-soo? Something like that. Doesn't matter. It's no big deal.
My buffers are blank.
Okay.
I can't get there from here.
All right.
After Zaki on the previous show referred to him as Kim Young Sun, which I don't think is right.
That was a great show, by the way. So anyway, it looks like mental capacities of Trump, number 45, not a legitimate 45, are declining. And now, it turns out, here's the main thing, though. It turns out he announced that this carrier group, and in his word, an armada, was heading to the Sea of Japan to try to intimidate North Korea. And it turns out they were going in the opposite direction. They're now just off the coast of Indonesia, 1,500 miles south of North Korea. Crazy. Crazy. I mean, so reckless with the truth and so reckless with American power. Also, Bill O'Reilly's show, The Sexual Harasser, Harasser-in-Chief, has lost 50 advertisers. And word is that the Murdochs, who own Fox News, are getting ready to fire O'Reilly. You know, it's really tough, Brother John. It's really tough to lose 50 advertisers and keep your gig. I mean, wouldn't it be great if someday I got to where I had 50 advertisers on Resistance Radio?
Well, as long as it didn't go to your head, Stuart, it would be wonderful.
Well, I'm not sure anything can go too close to my head as a former addict in recovery.
you know, I've seen so many examples of power corrupting people that I fear what would happen. I mean, but I tell you, I just don't see, even if you were transformed by some terrible disease,
right?
I still don't think that you would end up your first week in office being universally viewed as a jackass.
Lord, I hope so.
You could be.
I hope
you could have a ton of afflictions and still not, you know.
Speaking
go
of,
there.
Speaking of afflictions, Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa was pounded at her town hall meeting. And she admitted that our president has many character flaws. Lord have mercy. Now, that's a mouthful coming from a Republican senator from Iowa. And the FBI used the pee-pee tapes. Now, check this, folks. The FBI used the pee-pee tapes. That's the tape, or that's the dossier compiled by an MI6 agent that said, among many other things, that they had a video of Trump having a pissing party with prostitutes in Moscow at a hotel that President Obama once stayed at. So evidently, I mean, the dossier was good enough to get a FISA warrant to allow them to do deep intelligence on Carter Page, who was sent to the Trump campaign by Attorney General Jeff Sessions. You couldn't write this. I couldn't write this. This is so, every day is bizarre. And now it's all running against Trump right now. He's down to 38-39% approval rating. Won't be long before Republicans, particularly from in the Senate, who have statewide districts, are going to have to start disavowing him and walking away from him. It was fun this week. I got to go with four wonderful ladies from what we call Vigilance West Virginia and from the Democratic Party doing lobby visits on Monday. And we went to Senator Shelley Moore Capito and Congressman Mooney to talk to them about the budget, about taxes, about the wall, and about health care. We were fortunate to get in every place and to sit with their state directors. But right now is a great time for you to go see your senator. I think that's my friend Bill calling in.
Good morning. You're on the air. This is Enlightened Radio. Who's calling?
This is Bill Fletcher. I'm calling for Stuart.
Right. Good morning, Bill. This is John Case. Stuart is on the air here. Go ahead.
Hey, Bill. How are you?
I'm actually under the weather, bro, but otherwise, man. I'm okay. How you doing?
I'm doing good. We've got some good news from Trump land today. I was just telling our listeners about this. Now, brothers and sisters, let me let you know who's on our humble little show this morning. This is Bill Fletcher. Already, Bill, I told them they may want to Google you. He is one of the preeminent public intellectuals of our time. He is the preeminent labor movement or working class intellectual. He was the director of TransAfrica after Randall Robinson left.
Robinson, right.
He was the education director of the Service Employees International Union. When we changed that union from a sleepy union of about 500,000 members to give it the capacity to grow to 2 million members. And that's how Bill and I know one another. And that was probably 20 years ago, 25
that's
years
right.
ago.
That's right. That's right.
And he was also education director of the National AFL-CIO. And Bill, you know, Bill, you're not given enough credit for this. And so I'm going to give you some credit for this right now. I'm not just going to talk about you. I'm going to talk to you, and I'm going to listen to you.
Okay.
But Bill developed a three-day intensive economics class for labor activists that was remarkable. It led to me co-writing a book called Getting America Back to Work. And it was really a remarkable class. I think the Atlanta Labor Council, where I was president, was one of the first ones to have Bill come and give the class. And we had about 30 worker activists, union activists, take the class. And it was really a remarkable class and taught a lot of average folks a lot about the way this economy works. So thank you for that, Bill.
Oh, thank you, and thank you very much. Thank you for that support and that wonderful statement. Yeah, what you're describing is something that we called common sense economics.
Yes, it was, and we were the barefoot economists.
Yes, exactly, exactly. And it was a great team effort. We had a fabulous group of people that worked on putting it together, and had the labor movement actually risen to the occasion and fully operationalized that, I think that there might have, in fact, been some different election results over the last 20 years.
No doubt. I don't think there's any question about that, Bill. I mean, we continue to need to drill down with our activists and explain over and over again, because they hear so much false news. Speaking of false news, have you heard today, Bill, that the Murdoch family may be getting ready to fire Bill O'Reilly? That
I did.
He's lost 50 advertisers.
This is remarkable.
Yeah.
It couldn't happen. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, this is, you know, it's remarkable.
It really is.
But you see, the thing is that we have to keep in mind is that, you know, you lift a rock and you see all kinds of slugs, and then they disappear, you get rid of them. But under another rock, you'll find others. and there will be another Bill O'Reilly. They'll just have a different name.
Right.
And what people have to understand is the content of their character, to borrow a phrase, and that content is something that is replicated and actively replicated by right-wing elements. And this is not conspiracy theories.
No.
They are think tanks that create the sort of talking points.
Right.
Not sort of talking points, talking points.
Right.
That are used by the Bill O'Reillys.
The Rush Limbaughs.
Regardless of their name.
Right.
All over the country. Whether they're on AM radio, FM radio, television, or the web. But either case, you know, I think that the world would be a better place when Bill O'Reilly is outside of the media.
In the dustbin of history, right, Brother
Bill? Exactly.
Let me share something personal between me and Bill. We both carry American Indian genes in us, and I also carry, and we both carry American Indian genes in us, and I also carry African American genes in me, as obviously Bill does. But Bill is a descendant several times removed of Tecumseh, the Shawnee the Shawnee Indian war chief, who was one of the most powerful and effective warriors for American Indians in United States history. And
thank you for remembering that.
Of course, man.
And he was a great strategist.
And
I think that there's, I've argued, and I've actually been in the process of writing something that I call the Tecumseh paradigm.
Whoa! You've got to do that, man.
It's one of my tasks, right? And I've actually given speeches on this, but I'm actually trying to turn it into a chapter of a book, because Tecumseh understood the importance of the moment, and what I mean by the moment is this, Stuart. He understood. So for your listeners that are unfamiliar with Tecumseh lived. He was killed during the War of 1812. He was killed in 1813 in a place called the Thames in Canada, and his body was never recovered. He was born in the 1700s, and he was someone who understood that the influx of Europeans was creating a situation where Native Americans were going to face total defeat unless they did something dramatically different, and that they had a limited period of time to do this before they were simply outnumbered and outgunned. And so he spent the first decade of the 19th century, the 1800s,
right,
working to attempt what was actually successfully done in Japan in the 1860s, which was to, in the case of the United States, he was trying to knit together the Native American tribes into an Indian nation state.
Right.
And building a strong identity that went beyond the individual tribes.
Right.
And he was actually almost successful.
Right, right.
And
the Iroquois were pretty successful.
Could be learned from that.
And the Iroquois were pretty successful at doing that.
The Iroquois were, and in fact, the U.S. Constitution borrows from the Iroquois Confederacy.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Absolutely. But the Iroquois made the mistake that many other tribes made, which is that they continued to think at the level of fighting it out as tribes.
Right.
So the Iroquois were a confederacy of tribes, but they were not looking, or were at least not successful, in building the kind of linkages with the other tribes that were necessary.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Tecumseh was an incredible leader, an incredible war leader, an incredible political leader. We tend to think that if we don't have ballot boxes, that nothing is democratic. And in fact, most of the Native peoples' organizations, political organizations, were democratic, often led by women. In fact, most American Indian lineage is traced through the mother and the mothers, which is another sign that American Indians were superior to European Americans.
There you go.
We would live in a much different world if it wasn't ruled by so much testosterone, but by more estrogen. I'm so excited. This is enlightened Radio. Call up a friend or a neighbor. Tell them to turn it to www.enlightenradio.org and listen to Bill Fletcher talk about this moment in American history. Bill, I'm going to put you on the spot now, my brother.
Yeah.
I want you to, if you will, for me, please, yeah. I want you to talk about the resistance to Trump as a social movement. Does this feel like a movement to you? And relate it to social movement.
Well, this is definitely a movement moment. But let me back up and just say,
yeah.
Let's start with the mistake.
Okay.
The mistake that we made, the huge mistake that was made by so many people, was to underestimate. There's actually two mistakes: to underestimate the Trump candidacy, and to fall prey to the Tweedledee Tweedledum theory of politics that basically said that in effect there was no difference between Clinton and Trump. And
yep.
that they were both bad, and that it really wouldn't make that much of a difference who won. And that was a very, very fundamental mistake made by, in many cases, some really good people who did not understand the nature of the moment, which leads to the second point, which is a failure to understand the growth of what's called right-wing populism.
Yep.
Which is a political movement. It's what I call the herpes of capitalism. It is a disease that emerges when the system is weak. Uh-huh. And it comes out and manifests itself in all kinds of ways. It's very dangerous. It tears at the system. And it is, and then it may go away for a while.
Right.
But it's in the body. And right-wing populism is an irrationalist movement that looks to the past. It's not unique to the United States.
Right.
Al-Qaeda is actually a form of right-wing populism.
Wow.
It's something that looks to the past. It basically mythologizes the past and suggests that there was a moment when things were close to being pure.
Right.
When there was a greater time that we have missed. Right-wing populism uses sometimes language from the left in talking
yep.
about, you know, the poor versus the rich, but right-wing populists always look to divide up the population, not on the basis of class, but they look to do it usually on the basis of race, religion, ethnicity.
Yep.
And to identify certain parts of the population that are illegitimate. So right now, the presidential campaign in France, where Marine Le Pen of the Front National is in the lead, they're right-wing populists, and they have demonized Muslims.
Right.
And look at Muslims, regardless of what part of the world that they come from, as being incompatible with French culture.
Right,
and right-wing populism also has a genocidal gene within it.
Yep.
In the most extreme forms, you can see, like in the Rwanda genocide,
right,
was precisely a kind of right-wing populist movement that emerged and then just went completely ballistic. But you can also see in our own country, in the policies that Trump is advancing, a genocidal element where he
yes.
and the Republican majority are quite prepared, and this was demonstrated in the healthcare debate, they
yep.
are quite prepared to let people die.
Yes.
And to feel no compassion, no reticence about it. It's just sort of like
no empathy.
Says things happen.
Right. No empathy.
None.
Yeah.
None. It's sociopathic.
Right.
So,
wait, say that
so
again, my brother. Say that again.
It is sociopathic.
Right.
It is as you just said, this lack of empathy, this idea that it really doesn't matter what happens to this mass of people, even if it's millions of people, brown and black and yellow and red people, right?
Right.
So there was a failure to appreciate the growth of right-wing populism by many people, in part because right-wing populism, it has been ridiculed by many folks as opposed to analyzed and understood.
Oh, that's so rich.
When Trump was emerging, instead of looking at the social base that he was tapping into, instead of looking into the white folks that were confused and frustrated and resentful about how the American dream was no longer something that was within their grasp,
right,
and that they then would blame it on immigrants of color, African Americans, lesbians and gays, right? Instead of understanding that, Stuart, people, many folks just looked at Trump as a buffoon. And so that was, when I talk about we've got to understand the mistake, we've got to understand what happened in 2016 that led to this situation, right? So let me stop there for a second before I say what I think about the movement.
That is so rich. Yes, please. Talk to us about the movement. What do you think about the movement?
So I'm very optimistic. And I'm very optimistic because after a moment of paralysis following the election, and it was just a moment, there was this immediate outrage. It's the moment that exists when you've eaten some bad food, and then you know it's like when it goes down at first, you realize something's wrong, but you're not quite sure until you all of a sudden realize, oh my goodness, this is not staying down, and that's what happens.
And your whole body rejects it, right?
Right? Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
The body rejects it. And that's what happened after November 8th.
That's right.
It's sort of like, oh, my God, what did we ingest? And all around the country, you had these spontaneous uprisings, in effect, nonviolent uprisings, that were represented by people saying, no, we're not going to do this. The most significant being the Women's March.
Right. Right.
And the way that emerged, and I think it's useful to look at the Women's March on a number of levels, including the fact that when it emerged, it emerged with white women leaders, and that when the march was criticized, the leadership, to its credit, morphed and became incredibly diverse.
Right.
And I think that was a great example to other social movements of not being defensive, not falling into defensiveness, and recognizing when there's a mistake and that you can actually do something different. You can change.
Right, right. Oh, that's so rich, Bill. This is, this interview is going to make for a great podcast that John and I are going to get as far and wide as we possibly can. I like to say, and I've been... You know, I'm a bit of a student of social movements, as most good organizers are. And although I'm old now, I once was a very good organizer. That two of the elements of social movements are creativity and spontaneity, that people aren't waiting on orders from above. Or as a friend of mine in Illinois used to say, they're not waiting on the home office to call them and tell them what to do. People are picking up the cudgel and doing whatever they can, and certainly that is the case with the resistance to Trump.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody.
Oh, no, absolutely, Stuart. I mean, now, you know, I think what we're seeing with the environmental movement, we're going to have at the end of April, major demonstration here in Washington, D.C. We're seeing a number of good things happening, and but let me just offer a couple of words of caution.
Sure.
So one is that this resistance, the other side is anticipating that the resistance will die down.
Right.
So their plan is essentially to let us tire ourselves out.
Right.
And then that's that. So we have to understand that mass mobilizations are never in, they never go on indefinitely. They do die down at a certain point, which is why you've got to build organization. So in every state, we need to be building broad, united fronts of progressive organizations and institutions that exist to carry out both defensive work, like, for example, when immigrants and others are attacked,
mm-hmm. yes.
as well as to start planning out in state after state how progressives can win power. So you're in West Virginia.
Right.
And I was watching town hall that Chris Hayes and Bernie Sanders did a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Which was very interesting. I mean, there were some complicated aspects to it, but it was very, very interesting. And one of the things that I got from that was that there's a whole lot of regret about by many people about having voted for Trump.
Right.
And but people need direction. They need to figure out, well, what do we do now?
Right.
And that's where there needs to be, in West Virginia and in other states, progressives that come together and they basically say, we're going to map out a strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I'm going to Washington State in the middle of May because I actually put out a call for this kind of effort after the November election. And some folks in Washington State said, yes, that's exactly what we're going to do. And they're building
That's a great state. That's a great
that
state labor movement.
It is. It is.
Yeah.
But see, I want to be invited to West Virginia.
Well, you're going to be invited to West Virginia. There's no doubt about that. John and I will issue the invitation, my brother.
Well, I want to come, and I want to speak with progressives there that are not interested in being victims.
Yes. Yes.
Not playing victims.
Yes.
People that say we can turn this around, and that's what I'm seeing around the country. That people are beginning to think about. How do we build power? How do we build power for working people? How do we turn this around? And that's why I am optimistic. However, Stuart,
yes,
the movement you and I come out of, mm-hmm. organized labor, is right now really torn.
Yes.
And it is unfortunate that there are union leaders.
Right.
That have decided that it is fine to go have tea and crumpets with Trump.
Right.
And to try to cut a deal. And yeah. I look at that as in effect, the kind of collaboration that you saw in France after the Germans took over in 1940.
Right.
Where there were those that said, okay, let's cut a deal with the Nazis.
We
can save ourselves.
Our friend, one of the best organizers I've ever known, came out of the Teamsters Union. He was a Ron Kerry activist. David Eckstein was the first one to point this out to me after the Trump victory. But quite frankly, and I say this not to throw just to throw rocks. I say this so people don't mistake the rank and file of the labor movement with some of its leaders. Right now, the leadership of the labor movement, this doesn't mean every president of every union, but right now the leadership of the labor movement is failing the test. And by not being united, by not understanding that democracy that Trump and his folks are trying to destroy democracy, and so far are succeeding, and not understanding that the labor movement cannot survive absent democracy. We will be crushed. And you and I and John, we could spend the rest of our days in prison just for being who we are. And so it's sad and it's painful for folks like the three of us, John Case, myself, and Bill Fletcher, after spending an adult life in the labor movement, that we are failing at this task. I would submit that my hero, my mentor, my leader, John Sweeney, would never have failed this test. His instincts were too powerful to fail this test. But it's happening now.
It is happening.
Yeah, and we're going to have to work.
You're absolutely
right. We're going to have to work extra hard to avoid what happened in the 60s when the labor movement supported the war in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and ran off its natural allies. And so I'm going to keep saying we're making a mistake, because I want our natural allies to know that because the leadership has made a mistake, that doesn't mean the entire labor movement has made the same mistake. Does that sound fair to you?
I think it's very fair, and I guess I would go further, Stuart.
Please do. Well, yeah, you know, Bill, for our listeners, Bill always goes further than me.
No, not always. I think it's really important to call out these collaborators.
Yes.
And to point out.
Well, call them out. Call them out, brother. By the way, Bill, we're in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. But this is internet radio, so people all over the world are hearing you. Not a lot, not 50,000, but when we checked a few weeks ago, we had people in Turkey and Israel listening to us. And so you're not just talking to people in West Virginia, you're talking to people all over America and indeed quite possibly all over the world. But call them out.
That's great. Yeah. That's excellent. Excellent. Well, you know, here's the thing I'm thinking, Stuart. When some of the leaders of the building trades went to meet with Trump, there were two comments that were raised that I found quite remarkable. One was, I believe, made by Doug McCarron, the president of the Carpenters Union, who described Trump's speech, inaugural speech, as remarkable, something like that.
Yeah.
And then Terry O'Sullivan, the president of the Laborers Union, went on to
you and me used to really admire Terry O'Sullivan.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Right. And he went on to say that, you know, this is a new day for the American working class. And actually, I think it is a new day, but not the way that Terry meant it.
Right.
Let me just say what's interesting about this. I just want to start with Doug McCarron's statement.
Right.
I regularly say that in the United States, we oppose history. Hmm. We embrace mythology.
Hmm.
And one of the problems, we really hate history in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
We would rather that things are the way we want them to have been.
Right.
And one of the results of that is that we actually don't study and don't comprehend what has happened and its ramifications. So McCarron says that the Trump speech was great. So leaving aside the fact that what Trump was describing in many cases was the result of policies that have been pursued since the 1970s,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to something that had just happened under Obama.
Right.
The thrust of Trump's speech was this notion of America first.
Yep.
Now, if you don't know anything about history, you might just think, oh, that's like a kind of catchy phrase,
mm-hmm.
America first.
Right.
Yeah, we want to put America first. Well, that's why history is important, because America First was the name of a right-wing, isolationist, soft-on-fascism social movement, mm-hmm. prior to World War II, led by none other than Charles Lindbergh,
right.
the aviator who flew across the Atlantic. And as you know, America First sought to keep the United States out of World War II.
Right.
it was soft on the Nazis. In mm-hmm. fact, Lindbergh and Hitler and Hitler's group had a very cozy relationship. And the name of their movement was the America First Movement. There is no this is not coincidental
right.
that Trump, who surrounds himself with people who are sometimes called the alt-right, I call them fascists, but he surrounds
hello,
himself
somebody.
With people,
hello out right? there.
and that he would start talking about this America First. This is not accidental. He did not wake up on the morning of January 20th and say, you know what, I'm going to put these two words together, America and First. That's kind of cute. This sent signals out.
Yep.
And that's followed by other kinds of signals, like, for example, the on Holocaust Remembrance Day, not mentioning Jews. You know, things like that
right.
by the administration.
Right.
And so for Doug McCarron to talk about this was a great speech, for him to ignore the racist, sexist, xenophobic campaign that Trump led, I thought it was just outrageous. Absolutely outrageous. I don't call such a person a labor leader. I would say that this is a special interest leader.
Right.
This is the equivalent of a corporate lobbyist.
Right.
And I think it's very dangerous to have a situation where that is the face of American labor.
And for our listeners who may not understand, John Case, the founder of this radio station, CEO, president, Bill Fletcher, the foremost intellectual, public intellectual to come out of the American labor movement, and Stuart Acuff have all been involved in sustaining the institution of organized labor. We are not bomb-throwing or rock-throwing activists. We have been involved in the sustaining of the institution of American labor, but also of pushing the envelope of activism and movement building in the American labor movement. So when Bill says these words, they're very powerful and mean an awful lot. Let me ask you, following up on this discussion, and we're gonna have to have you back on again soon, Bill, because this is so rich and so important for our listeners. And
oh, I'd love to.
Yeah, and but let me ask you. You and I had a discussion about a year ago. You probably don't remember this, about whether Trump was a fascist or not. And mm-hmm. you reminded me that there are other anti-democratic forces besides fascism, as we were sort
That's
of
right.
figuring that out. John Case and I came to the conclusion, what, early summer last year, John, that Trump was a fascist. Let me ask you, with your wealth of knowledge, where Trump stands in a historical context?
Okay. well, you know, this is a very interesting question. I do not think Trump is a fascist.
Okay.
I think he is closer to Berlusconi
mm-hmm.
in Italy. I think he is a charlatan. I think he is an opportunist. I think that he is a right-wing populist.
Mm-hmm.
Fascists are a subset of right-wing populists, but they're not identical. And he is someone who is comfortable with people that are fascist or fascist-leaning around him.
But
when
he is an authoritarian,
fascist,
right?
I'm sorry.
He
Say
is
what?
An authoritarian, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He absolutely is. And I think that's one of the reasons that he quickly sent a congratulatory note to the Turkish president, Erdogan,
uh-huh.
who won the referendum the other day that makes Turkey further authoritarian.
Right.
So I think that he's definitely in that in that way. The thing about fascists is that fascists are a revolutionary right-wing movement. Revolutionary not in a progressive sense,
right,
but revolutionary in a sense of they seek to completely obliterate what exists and to replace the state with a form of a capitalist state that has no formal democracy, that is subject to arbitrary rule,
mm-hmm.
That is actively and quite consciously genocidal,
mm-hmm.
and militaristic, and so this this idea of completely uprooting the state, the so-called democratic capitalist state, mm-hmm. and replacing it is one of the key things when you're looking at these fascists. Now, fascists can and do present themselves in regular democratic elections.
Right.
But what you have to look at is what is their objective, not whether they participate in an election, because Hitler participated in an election.
Right.
But when you look at what the objective of the Nazis were, if you look at the objective of other sort of fascist groups around the world, you see that while they might utilize an election, their objective is eventually to remove elections, to remove electoral politics, to remove any semblance of political democracy. So what Trump is a cousin of Putin.
Ah.
He's an ideological cousin of Putin. He is an authoritarian who is prepared to use various means in order to exercise the power to advantage elements of the capitalist class, and it's very rough. I mean, so I'm not suggesting in any way. I'm not trying to whitewash
mm-hmm.
Trump.
Yes, yeah.
But I'm saying that we need to distinguish within the right. There are different right-wing tendencies. They tend to have different social bases and different objectives. So some of them are, so there are conservative forces on the right who are prepared to play patty cake in the electoral arena, at least up to a certain point.
Mm-hmm.
When you're looking at people like Bannon, these are people that have a very different view of the world.
Right.
And they do not see any great advantage of democracy. And these are people that, yes, they would eliminate people like us.
Right.
In a heartbeat.
And just for our listeners, friends and neighbors, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, when Bill said Bannon, he meant Steve Bannon, the chief strategist for the president, who is
correct.
An outright fascist, I think.
I would describe him as a fascist.
And you know, the probably principal figure who believes in destroying what he calls the deep state, which is basically
right.
the federal government.
Exactly.
Yeah. John Case is over here acting like Steve.
And Groucho Marx is over here too.
but Steve Bannon wants to destroy basically the federal government, and he is. It's hard to remind yourself that Steve Bannon is a person. One of the people most listened to by Donald Trump. A little bit less than before, but certainly most listened
to. Yeah, there's something going on
mm-hmm.
in the White House. It's unclear what the outcome of it is. But you know, what I would say, I would reframe what you just said,
mm-hmm.
Stuart. I would say that what Bannon and his cohort want to do is they want to overthrow the 20th century.
Ah, yes.
Right?
Yes.
Because there's many people, and including there might be some of your listeners that might say, well, getting rid of the federal government, well, that's not such a bad idea. But I think that it's important for people to understand this is not about just getting rid of this or that regulation,
right,
or whatever.
Right, right.
This is about overthrowing the victories that were won in the 20th century from 1912 on.
Right.
That they seek to return the United States. This is what goes back to what I was saying before about how the right wing looks to the past. Mm-hmm. They wish to return the U.S. to the state that it was in 1898 at the time of William McKinley, and they've said as much. Mm-hmm. Grover Norquist, one of the main architects of anti-tax movements,
right,
said that we need to return the United States to the era of William McKinley. That's 1898. And basically what they're saying is all of the victories that working people and other social movements have won need to be eliminated. You need to strip government down to the military, prisons, and police and fire.
Right.
And pretty much that's it. And you know, you're on your own.
You're on your own. Yo-yo. You're on your own. Mm-hmm. Our friend Jim Hightower was the first one who said that in my presence when he was describing the new ideology of the radical right. And let us not Absolutely. Be confused. This is not conservatism. And when the media calls it conservatism, they're not telling the truth. It's not conservatism. It's the radical right, way out of the mainstream of American thought and American tradition. Although there has, as Bill said earlier in this broadcast, Bill said earlier, there's always been an element in America. You know, Bill, I'm writing a lot of poetry these days, and I wrote one about a week ago about what we're going through. And it is true that our country was founded in part on genocide and slavery. And it infected our country. It tainted our country. It tainted our history. We can't deny that, and we can't overlook it. It's critical to understanding who we are. On the other hand, we can't be cowed by that, and we can't Right. fear that. We have to embrace it and understand it, and move against those impulses in American life. John's got something to say.
I read a transcript of excerpts from a speech by the, I think his name is Mr. Xi, the chairman of the Chinese Communist
Yeah.
Party.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was being questioned about his attitude toward Mao Zedong, the father of the Chinese Revolution, and also to comment upon the Cultural Revolution and Deng Xiaoping's, you know, reforms, basically mm-hmm. stepping back toward some kind of Chinese version of capitalism, socialism. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he was commenting on it, and he rather than answer the direct question, he said he went off on what appeared to be a tangent, which was he said the greatest mistake that the Soviet Union made was to criminalize their past.
Wow. Mm.
That it's one thing to change course,
right?
To recognize mistakes and do something different. But if you criminalize it, you may risk undermining the faith of your people in any government.
Right.
Or in any in their country as a whole. I thought that was a very interesting remark to make. He later went on, of course, to completely affirm everything that Deng Xiaoping pretty much had done. But he also made the point that I'm sorry that all the reforms we have made, all the progress we have made, none of that would have happened had the ancient regime not been overthrown.
Right.
Okay. So anyway, I thought, you have any thoughts on that?
Well, the next time you have me on, we'll talk about an analysis of the Chinese Revolution and the issue of Mao versus Deng.
Well, I was just thinking, do we need to criminalize Trump? That was my thought.
You know. I think that I think that Xi's comments are very, very profound. The problem is they don't apply to the United States. See, in the United States, we do not criminalize the past. In the United States, we mythologize the past. What we do is we eliminate that which we do not want to accept. So as a result,
we forget
the decision by, I believe it was Arizona, to not teach the true history of the Mexican-American War.
Right.
Right. To not have Chicano studies.
Right.
It's things like that. So what ends up being criminalized is the truth, and the refusal to come to grips with the past. So that may have been the ultimate intent of what Xi was talking about, that there's not like a full discussion about the past. The thing that we have, though, which I emphasized, is mythologizing the past. We want to believe that history. I'll give you an example of something that I've encountered in diversity trainings. I've had white guys that will come to me and they'll say, you know, my ancestors came to the United States legally, and they did what they had to do legally to get into the United States, and I object to people that are coming here illegally and jumping to the head of the line. And I've been thinking about this. So I get you. Now, let's stop for a second, and let's look at the history of immigration in the United States. Let's look at the fact that in 1793, the Naturalization Act said that citizenship was open to free white men.
Right.
So who were the white folks? Well, it wasn't necessarily all the people that we would consider today white.
Right.
So there were restrictions from the very beginning about who could come here. There was also, in the 19th century, the Chinese Exclusion Act and the cessation of Japanese migration to the United States. So instead of understanding history, people mythologize it. These guys that think, well, my ancestors came here legally, whether that's true or not is a whole other discussion. But leaving that aside, the fact that they think that it has all been peaches and cream,
right,
as opposed to understanding, and that's what we really got to get people to do, to understand the dynamics of U.S. history, both the outstanding things that have happened, the great struggles for social progress, as well as the horrendous things that have happened, as Stu had mentioned, in terms of genocide and slavery.
We're going to have to let you go here in a minute, Bill. We've actually gone over, but this has been a wonderful discussion. Friends and neighbors, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, you're listening to The Rock of Appalachia, Enlighten Radio. You've been listening to Bill Fletcher, one of America's preeminent public intellectuals, the preeminent public intellectual of the labor movement, a true tower of working class intellectualism, a great friend of mine, someone I'm honored and privileged to know and care about very much. Bill, tell us what's the latest book coming out, and then we're going to have to let you go, brother.
Well, so first of all, my website is BillFletcherJr.com for those that are interested in following me. I'm also on Twitter and Facebook. And I'm actually, Stuart, you may not believe it, I just got a contract for a novel.
Oh, great! And, good for you!
And so I've got the first draft of it, and I'm getting ready to start.
Who's going to publish it? Who's going to publish it?
A small publishing company in New York, Hardball Press.
Oh, yeah, good folks. Yeah. I know those folks. Great
folks.
So
they're going to be doing that, and I'm looking forward to that. It's a political murder mystery.
All right.
And then I'm exploring writing a nonfiction piece on the left and the current situation. What should people on the left be doing now?
So, anytime, my friend, you want help working on a piece, let me know. We've collaborated on several nonfiction articles and blogs. It's always a joy to do that work with you. We really appreciate you coming on today. Bill is in demand all over the country. We will have you on again very soon.
Hey, Bill.
Yes.
This is John. I was talking to a local mystery writer last week here, and I was, you know, a question I'd always ask about people that are launching a mystery story, and I says, what do you start with? And she says, the body.
And I just find out who comes. I wondered if you had a technique that you were going to follow, you know.
Well, no, that's actually my story begins with the murder of a construction contractor.
Oh.
And he's shot and killed with a high-powered rifle.
Wow.
Okay.
And then it goes from there to, like, what was really going on. This takes place in 1970. And what was going on, and what would have motivated this, and who was really behind it.
Wow.
And I will leave you guessing for
that. Do you even know? I mean, sometimes my friend says that, you know, she kind of finds out as she goes along, you know. That was a very interesting process.
No, that's true. In my case, I did, but let me put it in a different way. It took me years to write the story in my head. It took me about 4 months to actually type out the story.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So
that's
been
quick.
Through
Friends
the story
and Neighbors, 4 months.
Years.
4 months
and
for
then,
a year is quick.
Yeah.
I mean,
about
four months
to
for
write.
A novel. Yeah. All right, we're going to let you go,
okay.
Bill. Thank you
All right.
so much. Appreciate you
Thank
so
you.
Much. Brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, friends and neighbors, don't forget to be with us next week, Wednesday at 10 a.m. with another thoughtful conversation, hell-raising conversation, kicking up our heels conversation, Resistance Radio, Resistance to 45, Resistance to Trump. Thank you for being with us today. Bye, y'all. God loves you, and I love you. Bye-bye. Bye, Bill.